Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, January 26, 2022. We have three oral arguments on our calendar this morning, which you're hearing first on zoom.gov. Marshall, will you call the first case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Bryan, Judge Wheelock, the Honorable Lucinda E. Jessen presiding. Our first case is A210643, Kelly John Brown Petitioner Appellant versus Sean Marie Brown Respondent.
Good morning, counsel. Our rules when we conduct these hearings on Zoom are, as you probably know, very similar to the same rules we have in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your oral argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask you to introduce yourself each time you begin, because we do put oral recordings on our website to these, and that way it'll be easier for the public to follow. And if you have any technical difficulties during these presentations, let us know. We will stop and try and assist you. We really want to hear everything you have to say. And finally, you'll notice there is a clock in one of our Zoom corners, which will help you keep track of the time. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honors. My name is John Jerebek. I'm from Tuthlop, Jerebek and O'Connell, representing the appellant, Mr. Kelly John Brown. May it please the court, counsel. Mr. Brown seeks review of a decision or several decisions of the Hennepin County District Court in a dissolution matter based upon the findings of facts, conclusions of law, and order for judgment and judgment and decree that was entered on February 12, 2021, as well as an attorney's fees order that was entered on April 21, 2021. The parties were married in 1992. This was the second marriage for each of them. Appellant husband entered the marriage relationship with a significant amount of non-marital assets. The court in this case denied all his non-marital claims to real property. The court awarded spousal maintenance. The court awarded attorney's fees, and the trial court awarded a disproportionate share of the debt between the parties. And it's my client's position that he treated that the judge treated the parties differently with regard to that debt. With regard to the first issue presented in the brief, did the trial court abuse its discretion in refusing to value the party's real property as of the valuation date and ordering sale of all 8 parcels of the party's property? Pursuant to statute, Minnesota law mandates a trial court shall value marital assets for purposes of division between the parties as of the day of the initially scheduled pre-hearing settlement conference, unless another date is agreed upon by the parties. No date was agreed upon by the parties.
Mr. Jerebek, if I can jump in, I think we've read the arguments and are familiar with the statutes and the case law that applies. So if I could maybe jump forward a bit, the question I have as I look at the first issue about whether requiring sale effectively changes the valuation date is this. As I understand the division of that of those assets, if you look at page 58 of the order in paragraph 5, I think it's subparagraph G, where the district court then lays out what you do with those sale proceeds and the sequence of who, of what gets paid first, second, third, and any net proceeds are divided equally. So in that sense, once you've sold the properties and you're dividing equally the net proceeds, it seems to me that the division of property here is pretty much an equal division. And there's no need for a valuation date if you get the actual value of the property through a sale. So I guess that's my question is what do you think the division of the properties was here? Because it seems to me it was an equal division.
I would concur with you that the court ordered in equal division, and I will get into whether the court should have ordered something with the non-marital claim separately. But I do concur, it would be an equal division. I would say this, however, with regard to if there is a non-marital interest, that non-marital interest should be determined as of the particular date, as of the valuation date. The question comes up, if a court can just, and going back to the justification wasn't, I disagree with the appraisals. The justification wasn't, I disagree with the testimony. The justification was solely based upon the COVID-19 pandemic creating an issue that—
Again, I'm trying to separate out the decision that the district court made to essentially divide the property, those eight properties equally, from the decision about non-marital property and from the valuation date. So let's see, what is the importance of having a valuation date if you're going to order the parties to sell property and divide the property? Do you ever need a valuation date in that sense?
Right. If you are going to order the parties to sell the property, well, this goes back and it bleeds into the non-marital claim. Because if the court recognizes the non-marital claims, there is a significant non-marital interest that husband has. If that interest is there, and I understand not wanting to bleed into the other issue, if the interest is there, you're not selling the properties. And the reason you wouldn't sell the properties is because every time these properties are sold, what we're doing is diminishing the marital estate. So there might be situation where with one property, nobody wants that particular piece of property, and the court could order that to be sold. If an individual wants a particular piece of property and asks to be awarded that piece of property, this court has said you cannot include sale costs. You're also not paying a realtor to do this. It dramatically changes the amount that the individuals are receiving here. So, for instance, if Mr.
Counsel, we're looking at this for an abuse of discretion, right? And the way I look at it, I mean, okay, I understand you have a separate argument on the marital, non-marital. But would you agree that under the Nardini case, that district court can make that just and equitable distribution the statute requires it to make by ordering sale of assets? And I think that case particularly said where the parties disagree on the valuation, you can just order a sale. And isn't that exactly what the district court did here?
I do not believe that's what the district court did here, although I do understand that. And I do think there are particular pieces of property. For instance, you could examine Nardini. You can examine other cases where they said, with regard to this particular piece of property, we are going to put it on the market. And there was one piece of property here, which potentially nobody requested to receive that piece of property. And so you could put that on the market, and that makes sense. Do you sell where individuals disagree? Well, here, number one, the court never made Nardini-like findings here. The court only tells us, based upon COVID, that's the justification, that's the reasoning. So I would say that that is different because, and the COVID justification, going back to the statute, do the parties agree or is another valuation date fair? And then you can adjust that value.
But here didn't the court, in its findings, as I recall, gave at least the aggregate values of the parties, which were different, and then chose something kind of in the middle. So wasn't the court making the findings that the parties disagreed on valuation?
The court did give the aggregate findings. The court said, actually, I believe the court said they're somewhat similar in value, so you are making a statement as to value at that point in time. And then the court did make a finding, but they did not. The issue,
Jarabek, if I can jump in on the question of valuing the property or arriving at a value, and I understand that the district court looked at the two aggregate values and kind of came up with something roughly in the middle. Again, I'm struggling with what is a court required to do if it is going to, as allowed by our statute, by our case law, to order the parties to sell an asset or 8 pieces of real property. What is a court supposed to do then? Do they still have to come up with a determination of the value for each of those if it's an equal distribution? In other words, can't it just come up with a percentage? 50-50, 60-40, 70-30, whatever it might be, and set forth the sequence so that if there is non-marital property, that comes out first. And we're talking about net proceeds, division of net proceeds, division of the marital estate, not the non-marital piece, the marital estate being divided. What does a district court have to do if it's going to order the sale? Does it need a valuation date? And does it need to specify a specific value for each of those assets if it's just going to let the market set the value?
I mean, I understand that piece. However, backing things up, number one, I've never seen a court say sell everything when parties want some piece of the property. This judge says sell everything because of the impact of COVID, and I can't determine what the value is. Therefore, sell all property. When one of the parties was requesting certain pieces of property, when the parties...
So what's the authority for that rule? That if a party requests that they want to keep a property, that somehow the district court's precluded from ordering sale?
I do not have a specific case with regard to that. I would go back to the statute itself that says the district court is going to value all properties. And the language in 518.58 is the district court shall value all properties. When we change and say 2 years from now, we're going to sell the property, and understanding 50-50, 60-40, we're not yet into non-marital, and maybe we'll get there. But when we're looking at the value of that property, it's significantly different value of the property. So the non-marital claim is different with regard to the value of that property.
So if I may, I do want to turn to, given the limited time, to the marital, non-marital issue you raised, I think second in your brief. Just from our perspective and our standard of review, given the district court's credibility finding, you know, which we have to defer to, that your client's testimony was kind of manufactured post hoc, so it wasn't going to credit his testimony absent documentation. I guess my overarching question is then, where is the documentation that would substantiate your client's claims and the Sheridan, Thomas, and Elliott claims?
Right.
That would make that finding clear, make the district court's findings clearly erroneous.
Okay.
If you think I'm framing the issue the wrong way, let me know.
And it's not a framing of the issue. With regard to that issue, and I do point this out in my brief, with regard to Sheridan, it is clear. And here's where I think the trial court makes an error. Number one is an asset, is there a non-marital interest in the asset? That is question number one. And if we look at question number one with regard to Sheridan, what does the court find? The court actually says, we recognize and find it credible that he has a $37,586 interest in Sheridan. After you get that interest, the next part is the Schmitz formula with regard, and I'll do this with regard to Sheridan based upon the time.
Maybe I can save you some time, Mr. Jarabek, because I think we agree with that, those first two parts of it. The issue with the Sheridan asset isn't a documentation to support the down payment or the percentage or application of the Schmitz formula. The issue really seems to me to be the refinancing that occurs and whether as a result of what the parties did with the proceeds from the refinancing, was that commingled, then thereby converting what was marital or non-marital to marital. And then the second question is, what about improvements? And again, if you go back to what Judge Jessen said about the district court's credibility determinations about conflicting testimony regarding substantial improvements and how that was paid for, I'm sure you would agree that commingling refinancing proceeds and potentially spending money to improve the property would affect the value of the non-marital interest such that your client has to come forward with documentation as to what that current value of the non-marital interest is after those two intervening things happen.
I concur with that in a way. With regard to Sheridan, Sheridan's a little different because with regard to alleged improvements to Sheridan, that was the home where she alleged there were improvements to Sheridan. She said it existed. There was testimony, cross-examination with regard to it, and nobody found the improvements to Sheridan. There's no asset. There's no check. There's no item. There is nothing with regard to improvements. His testimony, and again, the court credits testimony how they choose to, his testimony was we didn't put anything into it substantially.
So let's assume that the district court credits wife's testimony regarding substantial improvements. Isn't it still husband's burden to establish the non-marital nature of whatever remains after those improvements?
But after those improvements, when you look at the testimony, there is nothing. I mean, and that's the issue with regard to, is it substantiated by the record? She is essentially does not make an argument. She makes an argument that there is this mythical improvements that occurred, and then there's no substantiation of what those are. There's no dollar amount of what those are. There's no anything. The accountant, her accountant is cross-examined and says, I don't know whether that was, you know, monthly payments just to maintain property or not. There are no improvements to Sheridan. Understanding what you're saying, and I do think that's more reflective with regard to the other assets and concerns with regard to those.
If I may, isn't it part of the record that the party's tax returns, in fact, show that those improvements were made to Sheridan?
And with regard to improvements versus maintenance, I believe that becomes the issue. And it is part of the tax returns that some money is paid towards.
So there was some documentation that at least established that funds from the tax returns went into that Sheridan property.
Some money went towards the Sheridan property. And then there's cross-examination. And again, they can credit cross-examination how they want to. But the issue here is nobody says what went in. You know, when you talk about Dorweiler, you talk about improvements, there's no determination of what those actual improvements are, nor does anybody ever testify to it.
Your time is up, but let me check with the panel and see if there are further questions. Well, thank you. We'll have additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent will turn to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Ann Hansa, and I represent the respondent, Sean Brown. On the issues before the court, the first issue is the issue of the valuation of the real property. I believe that the district court did not err by ordering the sale of the property. The case law is very clear that it is not legal error for the court to decline to value property when it's ordered to be sold. The Court of Appeals has affirmed district court's decisions where the court declined to assign a specific value when the property was sold. So as it relates to the sale of the properties, I think the district court exercised its discretion under 518.58 to sell or partition the properties where the values are in dispute. I think it's important to note counsel noted several times that the sole basis that the district court ordered the sale of the property was due to the COVID pandemic. And I would suggest to the Court of Appeals that that's not correct. She made several findings to support the sale. One was that the parties didn't agree on the values, the specific values of the individual parcels.
I mean, on that note, you would agree, wouldn't you, that there's nothing in the record to support the district court's finding about COVID impacting the value of the real estate. So to the extent that the district court was relying on that, that would be clearly erroneous.
I didn't hear the rest of your question. I apologize.
No, I just would you agree that the factual finding, to the extent it's a factual finding, tell me what you think about that COVID impacted the value of the real estate, that there's nothing in the record to support that finding, correct? That would be clear.
There is nothing. That is correct, Your Honor. There isn't, but that isn't the sole basis that the properties were sold.
I understand that. I'm just making the point. We've got to look at the other basis because that's not a legitimate one, correct?
Correct. I think the other basis, the two other basis, one was, if the appellant was going to keep the properties, how was he going to be able to service all the debt associated with the properties? He previously testified that during the pendency of the action, that he was borrowing money from family members. And I think the bigger issue was the court's finding that if all of the properties were awarded to the appellant, he failed to present any sort of a viable plan for how he would pay any sort of a property settlement payment to the respondent. So I believe that the court properly made the decision to sell the properties and did not need to come up with values as it related to the properties that were going to be sold, because I think, as the court pointed out, the value is what the value is at the time of the sale. The court identified a very detailed methodology for how the proceeds will be allocated between the parties.
Ms. Hansa, there are two aspects of the decision that I want, hope you can comment on and help us understand your side of it. The first is what's required when the district court is going to order parties to sell an asset and then divide those net proceeds 50-50. What is it that the court needs to do to justify that division of property? And did the court do that here? And then the second question is if you could respond to Mr. Jerebeck's point of law that where one party wants to keep an asset, there's some prohibition against dividing that asset.
Well, I will start with the second question first, because I don't believe there is any legal support for that. I think under 518.58, which is the division of assets, the court has the discretion to divide assets, marital assets and marital debts in any fashion that they feel to be fair and equitable. And that's what the court did in this case. The court looked at the parcels of property, which were the parcels that the parties did not agree on the values. She looked at what evidence each of the parties had supported, considered the fact that some of the parcels were wanted by some parties, some were not wanted by the respondent at all, and exercised the discretion that she had to order the sale of the properties. With respect to the first question, again, under 518.58 and 518.65, the court has discretion to sell the properties. And I think they did that. And I don't think the statute requires an equal division of the net equity. The court exercised the discretion and I believe made findings that an equal division of the net proceeds was fair and equitable between the parties. And I don't know if this was part of your question, but I would also note that part of the argument against the sale was that the court didn't make the requisite findings for an unfair hardship argument. And based on the McCoy case, the court did not make findings that there was any non-marital in any of the properties, but even if the court had, under the McCoy case, I still think that the properties could be sold. And then in the math calculation for how the proceeds were going to be divided, the proceeds could be divided in proportion to whatever findings had been made as it relates to the non-marital. With respect to the non-marital claims, the primary claims are in the Sheridan, the Thomas, and the Elliott property. In the Elliott property, and I do think it's important to note that the court did make a specific finding that she wasn't going to consider any of the appellant's testimony as to the non-marital claims unless it was specifically corroborated by credible documentation. The first claim was in the Elliott property. This was the property that was owned by the respondent prior to the marriage. the appellant's claims were twofold. One was that he used his money to buy out the respondent's former husband. He failed to produce any evidence to support that claim. And the second claim that he made was that he used some distributions from premarital retirement assets and sale of 3M stock. And the court specifically acknowledged that he may well have had those assets. But the difficulty that the court made was that there was no documentation to show the actual flow of the sale of the 3M stock into any improvements in the Elliott home, which then resulted in her concluding that the appellant had not met the preponderance of the evidence burden in the Elliott property. The Sheridan property was the property that the appellant owned just prior to the party's marriage. And I think the court did, as acknowledged in the previous oral argument, acknowledged that at the time of the marriage, there was some non-marital interest in the Sheridan property. Where the non-marital claim fails is that during the party's marriage, the parties did improve. And contrary—
My name is Hansa. The court also relied, it seems to me, on the fact that the appellant purchased the property in anticipation of the marriage or something close to that. And I just don't see a basis for why that becomes a factor in the marital, non-marital assessment. So shouldn't that trouble us?
I don't think it should trouble you. I'm aware of the finding. I don't think that diminishes the rest of the non-marital argument that the court made, that the appellant failed to prove that the initial non-marital interest that was in, I think it was 26.5%, that he failed to meet the burden of where it is today. And that was due to a number of findings. One was that there was multiple refinances of the property during the marriage that hadn't been, no documentation had been shown. And very specifically, there was documentation, namely a 2017 tax return that specifically identified improvements. And there was testimony between the distinction of improvements versus repairs that were done to the home. The tax returns for the Sheridan property specifically identified the dollar amount as being improvements. And again, the burden is on the appellant to prove where the original non-marital was at the time of the dissolution. And the court, I think, appropriately found that, you know, you may well have had some non-marital at the time of the marriage, but you didn't prove and provide me with the documentation necessary to prove what that dollar amount is today. And that was the same or similar argument for the Thomas property. That was also a property that appellant purchased prior to the marriage. The court said he may well have had some non-marital interest, but unlike Sheridan with the Thomas property, there was no documentation to show a purchase price. There was no documentation to show what mortgage balance was owing at the time of marriage. All the information that appellant produced to the district court was estimates from his expert, estimates on, you know, using what the city of Minneapolis housing market appreciates at. And so the court, and also the court noted that in that case, there was a tax return that showed that there had been improvements. Again, improvements were the words on the tax return made during the marriage. And because the court found that the non-marital claims in Sheridan, Elliott, and Thomas, those three, the appellant failed to prove, then his claims in the other property, the cabin property, the Connors Lake property, the vacation rental, and Devil's Lake, all failed as well, because the claim in those properties was that we purchased it with refinance proceeds from Thomas, Elliott, and Sheridan.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. If you could, wrapping up that argument, I had a question on a different issue.
Of course.
I wanted to talk with you about a matter appellant didn't raise in his oral argument, but did in his brief, and that is about the district court's order of the $500,000 life insurance policy to make to secure the maintenance award here. And appellant makes the argument that, and you can tell me factually if you agree with this or not, that look, your client's monthly investment income from that policy could exceed the actual monthly maintenance award. And so I'm struggling with what could be a disproportionate amount of life insurance. So what standards should we be looking to? I mean, if the court district court had awarded a $3 million life insurance policy to secure maintenance, I mean, would you agree that would be disproportionate? How do we draw those lines?
Well, under the case on the statute, the court's required to look at two things, the cost of the insurance and the insurability of the payor, not whether it's excessive. And the case law clearly says the court simply has to look at the cost and the insurability. And in this case, the court did. At the time of the trial, the appellant was insured. So there was no issue of insurability. He had $560,000 worth of insurance. She also analyzed the cost. $240,000 of the $560,000 was available to him free of cost through his employer. The additional coverage cost $87.73 per pay period. And so the cost, the court did what the court needed to do in analyzing cost and insurability. And I don't believe that there's any case law or legal authority that requires her to look at whether the insurance is excessive or not. In my remaining time, I'll just touch briefly on the issue of spousal maintenance. I think the court properly analyzed all of the factors that the court needed to do. In fact, the court's award of spousal maintenance to the respondent was substantially less than the amount that was requested. The appellant seems to take the position that the court erred because the court didn't analyze all of the factors or didn't make specific findings on how the respondent's time away from work impacted her employability. Quite to the contrary, there was nearly three pages of findings about the respondent's work history, her time off of work to raise children, her work history in part-time positions, and appellant's own expert on cross-examination, interestingly enough, agreed and conceded that the appellant or that the respondent was appropriately employed and that there was no need to make any further adjustments to her income. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you for the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. John Jerbeck, again, counsel for appellant. I would like to address three issues. First of all, going back to the Sheridan property, there's the indication that the district court did not make findings with regard to the district court made findings with regard to credibility of that initial determination with regard to the value of that property. The district court, and it's clear, especially with regard to Sheridan, the Schmitz formula should have applied to that property. You have a 26.5% interest in the property. If you apply Schmitz, and the court erred by not doing it, if you apply Schmitz, that would be, I have it here, a non-marital calculation of 26.5 would be $135,680. Now, that would be the non-marital piece. And then there was talk again, and I asked the court to look at the record. Is the claim with regard to the improvements to Sheridan supported by the record? The interesting part there is husband testifies no improvement. Wife testifies there were, but she doesn't know what they were. The accountant says there's something on the tax returns. What is it? He doesn't know what they are. So,
Mr. Jerbeck, if I can If I can ask a question about the burden of proof here, right? We have a presumption that property is marital, that it's the burden of the party requesting non-marital property to prove that it's non-marital. What happens in this situation where you have an initial step where you can say, yep, that down payment, we all agree, let's say in a case that down payment was non-marital, but after that, there's a dispute about whether the refinancing gets commingled. So the parties don't agree on the current value of the non-marital interest because of intervening action. Whose burden is it to establish the current value of the non-marital interest?
That is a great question. And I have attempted to research that question in and of itself. When somebody establishes their non-marital and then Dorweiler comes in, but it's the other party claiming that there were improvements to the property, whose burden is it at that point? It's my position that it would be the burden of the individual claiming that there were some improvements to the property. Now, you're going to ask, do I have legal justification? I don't. I haven't seen this switch to Dorweiler. The other situation, understanding counsel argue with regard to Elliot, that is more traditional with regard to Dorweiler, where husband is alleging these improvements occurred. Husband establishes, and he does establish, I took all of this money out of my retirement plan. The husband establishes there is no other source of money. The court does make other findings saying, I don't think there's income here to support all of this. I don't know how this would occur. Well, there's a logical explanation, and nobody refuted the fact that the only way this money came was from his retirement funds. There was no other source. And so, and the court saying, and the court makes findings throughout, I don't know where he has additional income. I don't know if he could pay for all of these properties. And with regard to the other issues, the way he paid for them and the way he continued to pay for them was taking those money out of his account. So the unfortunate piece for my client is that he brings these assets in and brings the assets into the marriage relationship and, according to the court, should leave with nothing with regard to his non-marital. A couple more issues to talk about briefly. With regard to the spousal maintenance piece, the big piece with regard to spousal maintenance is wife testifies she received income from a cattle business of approximately $5 per pound hanging weight, less processing fees. Now, she did not, when questioned about that revenue, her testimony was there's a difference between income and profit. And she admits on cross-examination she would have income off the cattle business. The trial court then finds respondent credibly testified she has not earned income off the cattle operation. That is not what she testified to.
Mr. Jeffrey, your time is up. We'll give you a few sentences here to wrap up.
Yeah. She testified that she did not remember the revenue because there's a difference. And I would point out lastly that with regard to self-employment, that burden, and I understand the question that was asked previously, that burden clearly does switch to her to establish what those expenses are.
Are there further questions from the panel? With that, we'll thank both counsel for their helpful arguments and briefing. The court will take the matter under advisement and a decision will be issued within 90 days. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.